The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
Jason Williamson, Andrew Fern, welcome. Sleaford Mods, of course. I want to start really about your backgrounds and the families that you were brought up in, and whether there was any cultural atmosphere where you could really envisage having a cultural output later in life.
Didn't really think about it. Was never politically conscious. Was never conscious of poetry. Was never conscious of, well, you know, not a lot. You know what I mean? Right up until the last minute, I suppose. I don't know. You know, once you learn how to vocalize things, once you know, a lot of people don't connect themselves to the matters in hand. You know, life, society, the constraints, the constraints of all that. But if you do, and you come from a background that is very much embedded in work, very much embedded in working class culture, then you do marry the two together. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I completely understand that. I just come to Andrew though, because the background that I was brought up with, my father was a market trader, my mother was a nurse, and so they both would say to me, you know, you've got to get something where you earn money.
Yeah, I think quite across the board, you know, lots of people. I mean, I can remember at school having friends whose parents educated them at home. You know, they had like a parent who was a teacher or just educated them at home, you know, and they definitely had an advantage. And I think, you know, like Jason was saying, not knowing about poetry. I mean, I knew about things like that, but it didn't really make any sense to me. You know, I didn't really know. I didn't really grasp it. It wasn't until I left school that I started to educate myself that I really understood what English literature and the English language actually meant. You know, I think if you've only got, I mean, without you particularly gifted anyway, but, you know, most kids growing up in the 80s that didn't have academic parents, my dad's quite dyslexic. You know, he's a plant hire business that he's been successful at, but he's basically used his hands and worked hard to achieve money, you know. And you don't, what am I trying to say? It's you just don't understand what's education, you know. You don't have that connection with it until you make that connection yourself. School never gave me that connection with English literature. We had terrible teachers for English at school.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah. And same for history. I'd say the same about history. It wasn't until I left school that I thought, oh, history's actually quite interesting.
Well, they're just teaching the same old shit, don't they, you know? It's not really proper history. It's just their account of a nice gentrified English history, isn't it? You know?
And they just seem like they didn't enjoy teaching it either, you know?
No.
So what music were you brought up around, Andrew? What did your parents play at home?
Well, my mum was quite into music generally, you know, but just the obvious sort of commercial end of the Beatles, Elvis, a lot of rock and roll stuff, you know. But then as I grow up, I used to see albums on TV, like KTEL albums and compilations, even when I was really young, and I'd just stick them in my mum's trolley when we go to Asda. And she would kind of want the record as well, you know. And that was it, really. There wasn't really any particular family member that was really into music.
What about you, Jason?
Like TV, really. Top of the Pops when I was a kid, like 8 or 9, and the kind of records your dad played. And just like looking at pop stars on Saturday morning kids programs as well. And
pick
then
things up, don't you?
Yeah, you just pick it up, and then around 10 years of age, properly got into, you know, punk, Sex Pistols and stuff. Was introduced to that with, by my stepbrother's vast record collection of punk and new wave punk. By then it was new wave. There was a second wave of punk with the Exploited, GBH, all that business, you know what I mean? So yeah, I got interested that way. But again, didn't really connect that with anything socio-political, do you know what I mean? Just too young, you know. And I think you don't really start looking at it until you start suffering, which is usually from around 21. You know, when you're thrust into, well, I, 16, 17, I went to work. So it was like a wake-up call. But I consider that to be like earning my common sense stripes, you know, being able to do practical work fast under a lot of pressure and working with a bunch of fucking savages, basically, you know. So, it took a while. No, nobody gives a fuck about politics down there, do they? Down in the lower ebbs of society. You know, not a lot of people do, which is why they are thrown around so much by those at the top.
You know, the 90s was, people were just drunk, stoned.
Yeah, that was, again, it was...
You know, I used to know a bunch of people that lived at Nine Lady Stone Circle, which is it's in Derbyshire, on a bus, you know, and like there was one guy that used to wear a dress and they just taking mushrooms up there every day. They just lived up there for like 4 months, you know, and we'd go and visit. And, you know, that's kind of the sort of thing that you would...
Yeah.
I used to know Pitch Shifter. I used to go around to their house and sit in their room while they were jamming, and they're just a bunch of crusty stoners. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Different world.
You had it good round there, I think. I should have done that rather than around pretentious clothes shops doing cocaine.
Yeah.
Your parents separated when you were very young, Jason. How did that make you feel?
I was just like gutted. It was horrible. You don't want that. You know, splitting up, that's not right. And I think that's affected me throughout. I think my relationship with other people, with women, initially was kind of, I didn't like splitting up. Or I got clingy because I didn't want to feel like that again, because it was like a broken heart. Even though like your parents aren't perfect and you just don't want them to go away. To, you know, you've been brought up with these two adults, and therefore, regardless of their limitations or whatever, you want them to stay together.
Yeah.
So it's quite violent, divorces, I think. It has to be handled well. And I think my parents probably didn't handle it very well because they were very young. I think you can separate and you can handle it very well, but you've got to really, really include the kids, but in an intelligent way. And also you can't be arguing in front of them, you know, and stuff like that. I think there are ways for children to understand that sometimes adults just don't get on, you know what I mean?
The reason I ask that, though, is because my parents split up, and I found out later that my father, when my mother had a third child or got pregnant with a third child, which was me, my father already wanted to leave her and didn't have anything to do with me. And I feel that I've eventually became a presenter on MTV, and now I'm a writer, and that my drive came from this perceived lack of love from my father. And I just wondered, because I've done a lot of research into sort of a lot of very famous singers, and a lot of them have a wound in the childhood, which seems to relate to them getting their drive and being successful.
Oh, I totally think that it's connected to that, without a shadow of a doubt. Totally think that my need for attention comes from that, without a doubt, you know.
That's not me.
You know, you can't, I wouldn't deny that, absolutely not. But I guess there's worse things to fall into, isn't there? It's like, you know, it's you deal with your traumas, don't you? We all do. And some people don't. They just linger with people. And, you know, some people don't know how to deal with them. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But it's like, I think, yes, possibly the quest for, you know, the motivation, as you said, Steve, I agree. You know, it's I think that was powered by that, definitely.
Andrew, how about you? I don't know what your family background is, or where do you feel that your drive may have come from?
Well, I was going to say, you know, my parents didn't get divorced, but a lot of friends around me, most of my friends' parents got divorced. And particularly one family in my village who were close friends, you know, it kind of worked out really well for them. You know, when their mum met someone else, their kids got on really well with them, and it just made their family bigger.
Yeah.
You know, and my family were very much, they were out every weekend just getting shit-faced, you know, and I was very much home alone quite a lot, you know, from like 11. So I guess, yeah, maybe it comes from that. You know, I always felt like, because I've got a brother that's 5 years older than me. So once I was, you know, 10 or 11, he was out, you know, he was never at home. So, yeah, you know, I don't know. It's all relative, isn't it, to your own experience? You know, people think my parents weren't rich, but they were, my dad was doing all right for himself, better than a lot of people in the village. So, yeah, you know, it's definitely spent a lot, too much time on my own probably from that age, you know. And I was already like, you know, wanting, I can remember buying a keyboard get for Christmas, you know, wanting this little keyboard and just recording things with crappy tape decks and, you know, just wanting to make music, really.
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to deride my taste probably here, Jason, but when I was a teenager, which was, I was 13 in 72, so I'm a generation older, Bowie was a big hero at that period. But it wasn't just his music. He provided a world where I wanted to sort of go into from my parents' world, and particularly as sort of a young gay teenager. For me, he represented some sort of sexual freedom apart from everything else in the music. And the 70s was a really sort of nasty era of, you know, anything that could, any homophobia, sexism, racism, misogyny, the whole bloody works. The 70s was packed with it more than any other decade, I think. But is there a musician that really sort of showed you a world through their music that you wanted to enter?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if I wanted to enter their world. I mean, I was heavily influenced by the Sex Pistols initially, but it wasn't, I don't know if wanting to be in their world was the right thing. I don't know. I found escapism with it. I found escapism with the Jam. But again, Paul Weller, it looks to be a very regular bloke like anyone, you know what I mean? So I don't know if there's any, if there's much there to escape into. He's a very kitchen sink type songwriter. You know, very English, very miserable, but not, you know, there's nothing much to escape into there, but I think it was more identifying with these people. I identified with Steve Jones from the Sex Pistols and Paul Weller because they reminded me so much of everyone in my environment, you know. And although the Pistols were a working class band thoroughly, I kind of identified more with Steve Jones and Paul Cook because they seemed... They just looked like every other person that I knew. Do you know what I mean? And Paul Weller as well, to a certain degree. So I think it was identification, really. There wasn't any escapism. Just probably escapism in the idea of mod or the idea of fame, You know, but I didn't really equate that with music too much. It was more film that I equated the idea of fame with.
Okay, Andrew, what about you? Was it, were there soundscapes that musicians made that sort of provided sort of a...
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say, you know, same before, you know, I didn't really mention, you know, because I'm gay as well, but I didn't really, I don't think that really affected me in a, you know, my ambitions, if you like, you know, but I think sort of like 14, 15, I was crazy about the Pet Shop Boys, like the first two albums. And just completely production of the music. So it's probably whoever, you know, Trevor Horn or whoever produced the stuff, Stephen Hague and people like that. Then really, you know, because it was headphone music that I would escape into a world of that they create, which was a kind of a looking, you know, looking at it now, it's not a really very, it's a very sort of image based world, isn't it? You know, like, you know, the album covers and stuff that they, the seven, yeah. You know, the images, it's very sort of, you know, even though I didn't pick up on the fashion element of it, it was just that escapist world, you know, the whole thing's about escaping, you know, and also the fact that I knew they were gay and they didn't come across like other flamboyant pop stars did in the 80s, you know, even though people knew that they were gay, It didn't look gay, you know, which I guess I kind of largely related to, you know. I was one of those gay kids at school. I wasn't on the radar. People didn't know I was gay. Whereas there was other kids at school that couldn't hide it, you know. And I just watched this kind of like teen film yesterday called Love, Simon, which dealt with it really well because he's exactly like that. And he starts chatting with a guy online, and then he's in the library, and he leaves the computer open, and someone else finds it, so he starts blackmailing him, and he feels like he's losing control of his identity because he can't choose when to come out, you know. So I kind of related to that quite a lot because it's not a big deal that you're gay, but even in the 80s, but. It, for some reason, it's something that you have to deal with at the same time, you know, and it kind of gets hyped up. So I think when I left school, I basically just went, you know, I was basically just pent up because I couldn't express myself at home.
Sure.
And just went mental and took loads of drugs and, you know. I didn't really see a future for myself, you know, I didn't really... Yeah. You know, I can remember turning 16 and the age of consent had been lowered to 16 when I turned 16. But at the same time, they banned any sexual imagery from television, from the BBC. So it was a double-edged thing going on there, which was very confusing at the time. Do you know what I mean? And I just felt really, you know, it made you feel excluded from gay culture, really. You know, like you didn't really feel part of it. And yeah, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of people that can relate to that, you know, because you're a little bit older, aren't you, than me?
I'm born in 1959, so I think I'm pretty much a lot older.
Well, I mean, you know, if you're sort of part of the, if you're over 50, I'm 51, so if you kind of like dipped into the 70s more and you have Bowie, you kind of had a different kind of world or different experience. But for me, it was a completely 80s experience, which was... I don't know. Do you know what I mean? It's quite debauched at the same time. Do you know what I mean? It's like you either dive in and you know, which wasn't really what I was like as a person. So it's not.
You both mentioned drugs already, and
yeah.
because I had this massive phase as well where I went completely deranged, and it was basically. Over a sort of 10-year period until I lost everything. And I just, you know, and at party drugs. So mine were like coke and E, and I'd do what I think, you know, in essence, what you're saying, Andrew, is I would go to clubs and go completely bananas. But it was all about, when I look back on it, and I don't have a moral perspective to it, all I have is that it was an era where I was escaping myself. And I was fooled by drugs because I felt they were giving me something until years later where I realized that they weren't fulfilling me or giving me any creativity or giving me anything in my life, essentially, apart from going completely fucking bananas. So how do you, Andrew, first of all, how do you view drugs in that perspective and what they gave you and what they took away from you?
Yeah, so my thing was acid. Do you know what I mean? We were all doing acid, which, I mean, I think hallucinogenics are a little bit more rewarding, but you know, initially, because you have some quite memorable experiences, but it did get to a point where we were doing it every weekend and it wasn't really doing what it used to do, you know. Of course, after that, when ecstasy came in, you were doing that as well. But yeah, you know, I mean, again, it was, I think the thing about escaping was you didn't, you know, as a creative, I didn't make any music. You know, when I lived in Newark, the 3 or 4 years I was in Newark after school, I was just getting absolutely wankered all the time. You know what I mean? But as soon as I moved to Nottingham, I bought a 4-track, borrowed a guitar. I started making music instantly, you know. And before that, when I was at home, even if I only had a keyboard to play, you know, I was always like playing it. I was just obsessed with playing, making music, you know. So it created a bit of a, you know, what I kind of became, which is very sort of, you know, sort of double-edged. I could be quite recluse for a while and stay in and just make music. And then I think, well, for my own health, I better go out for a bit.
How about you, Jason?
Yeah, cocaine and the same, really. Cocaine and ecstasy, speed at the end. But yeah, I'd lost everything a few times, actually. you know, fortunately, my mum had always took me back 3 times and would, you know, if I got into trouble with any dealers or just needed money for drugs, I'd get it off my mum. So it was a bit of a weird one, really. You know, she got into debt for it. But, you know, when I've spoken to her recently about it, she said she did it because she could understand why I just wanted to forget all the time, because life wasn't very good, you know. She could understand that, she said. So that's why she would do these things. So yeah, you know, I think it's I regret it. I regret taking so many drugs because I'm so active now. I literally, you know, a lot of things, nothing seems like it's a problem. And if there is a problem, then I'll deal with it. You know what I mean? Before I didn't. So you know, I do regret it. But at the same time, there is a whimsical part of my memory that has, you know, some nice thoughts about those times. You can't beat cocaine. It's fucking brilliant, you know. You can't beat alcohol. It's absolutely brilliant. What an invention. But, you know, you just can't, if you are any which way inclined to not handle it properly, you can't keep doing it. It will destroy you. So
I think it's more about escaping, though, isn't it? Like, if you want to escape and you're happy to escape, whatever you're doing, it's great, isn't it? Because it's working. It's doing what you want to do. But then,
yes,
you know, if you've got shit that you want to do, you know, you can't be stoned all the time. You can't.
I think you made a point that's really fascinating, because I feel that as a writer, that although that era I didn't think was a creative era at the time, I feed off that era because so many, you know, as you said, I was so wankered, that, you know, I had so many mad experiences in that period that I can feed off that period. Is that the same?
Absolutely. There's two phrases. There's one which is there's a phrase that says make new mistakes. And then someone said to me, I think I was from my 30s, I said to a mate about, I feel like I've wasted a lot of time. And he said, life's for wasting, you know, like, and you can't have a perfect life, can you? Do you know what I mean? You're not in the military in some sense. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you're supposed to do these stupid things in life, and it's the only way that you learn things, you know. It's the reason that academic people that go into a job aren't very good at it, because they've got no life experience, you know.
Yeah.
You're listening to Pop, the History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
Jason, you said that it's powerful not to have money. How impotent is it to have some money?
Well, you know, it's good. Of course it is. Is it powerful? No, I don't think it's powerful. I mean, you don't have to worry so much about buying stuff, but I don't know whether that's a form of power. It's more a privilege, isn't it? I suppose. I like having money more than not having it, but you know, I'm not rich. I mean, I could probably not work for 3 years, but then I'd have to go back to work. And I know work. I did work for 25 plus years, or God, longer. So to be able to not work for 3 years and then have to go back means nothing to me, absolutely nothing. I may as well go back to work next week. So, I don't consider myself to be, we're not rich. Of course we're not. We're not millionaires. Do you know what I mean? That's rich, isn't it? I would say that, or is having £500,000 rich? I don't know. To some people, it probably is, those that haven't got it. But the idea of rich is not to worry about it forever, isn't it? So,
I think the idea of rich is doing what you want to do, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, no, because rich means to me having money in the bank. That's rich. Right. I mean, kind of richness in like variety and outlook and perception. I would say that was more a bourgeoisie notion, isn't it? So you just don't think like that when you are at the lower ebbs of society, you know. It's almost like a wellness sentiment, isn't it? You know what I mean? You know, nobody's got time for that shit if you haven't got a lifestyle to match it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the thing that Bob Marley was asked that on a sort of thing recently. I can't remember exactly what he said, but, you know, he basically responded by saying that money's not what makes you rich, you know. But imagine Bob Marley, it's a different, you know, the world that he created for himself. Do you know what I mean? Money didn't make him rich, but, you know, when you're sort of a relatively lower middle class and living, you know, I'm renting at the moment, you know what I mean, I've got to pay my rent. I'm not living that kind of lifestyle, you know. But you know, some people don't need money and they don't care if they lose all their money and they'll still be happy. So I don't think I would be.
When you create something, you're often, like when I write, I'm often going through the themes of my life in what I'm writing. So I'm constantly sort of regurgitating these themes that have been important in my life and in some way moving on from those themes. But what works in my writing are still those themes. So for you, Jason, how much of a change have you seen in yourself from your lyric writing into, you know, your sort of perceptions of the world and the perceptions of who you are?
Since when? Since it started?
Yeah.
Well, there's been a change, yeah. It's been a gradual change. But it has been there. It's shifted completely. The political things are still there, but now they're more better articulated, perhaps, to a certain degree, or more in keeping with my current position. You know, I'm no longer working in an office or a warehouse or whatever. You know, I'm a successful musician. So, they've changed and matured and become, I think, a bit more intelligent, perhaps. Do you know what I mean? Totally.
And how is it for you, Andrew, you know, I've got a friend who's she's a DJ in Norway, and she maintains that also creating the music has a massive therapeutic value on her life. So I just wonder whether there's a similarity, because your experience I'm detached from in that sense.
I mean, I wouldn't, if I wasn't successful with Sleaford Mods, I'd still be making music. You know, I was making music before and putting it on Bandcamp for not many, no one to listen to, like a lot of people out there that haven't been discovered or whatever, you know. So yeah, it's definitely something that that's a therapy, you know, that I do on a daily basis. You know, always thinking away at something.
So if the inspiration for the lyrics is the state of Britain, and British politics, how does that feed into the inspiration for the music?
Well, music's a different thing, isn't it? I think music's, you know, it's a relationship that you have with how you understand music, you know. You are in some ways a vessel for stuff that's out there in the ether to be created, but you've got to listen in to make it, you know. You've got to tune in, as they say, you know, to and we've slowly created the Sleaford sound, as you know, since I've started it. So, you know, it's just it's a subtle thing, you know, of paying attention a little bit, but not too much, and relaxing into it, and just enjoy making music. Because that's what I always did when I was unemployed. I had no money. That was something that I always felt couldn't be taken away from me. You know, that's what got me through days of having no money, because I already had some gear, you know, a laptop to make music with. So I'd be like, right, well, I'm not going to be bored. I don't need television. I can just make music at home, you know.
So, Jason, how do you see the creative process between you when you come together and make music? And how do you see the division of roles? I mean, obviously, there is a division of roles, but is it completely distinct, or can you sort of cross over into each other's area?
Sometimes.
Subtly, we can, yeah.
Yeah, subtly. It's not. I can't engineer, and you know, I can't. Physically record any production ideas. So mine's just communication, really. If the roles do, you know, Andrew can blurt out a melody, and I get the gist straight away. And I'll, you know, if I've got an idea for, you know, sort of production, then I'll just, you know, I tell him vocally, and that's as far as that goes, you know. Most of the time, ideally, it's the music's done. We don't really need to do much to it. Andrew might do something. There might be an odd suggestion from me, but not, you know, it's not too in depth, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and there's the occasional time that, you know, Jason will be writing a second or third verse for a track, and I'll be stuck on something that, again, he will communicate through, you know. And then it might not be the thing that I say, but the thing that I say might inspire him to
think of something else.
So there was a bit of conversation involved there sometimes. But
again,
you know, that's the great thing about it. They come in different forms, the tracks. You know, sometimes they're just completely there, which feels like you have been a vessel to sort of create it. And other times you have to sort of squeeze it out a bit more, you know.
So what about when you work with other people like Billy No Mates or on the UK Grimm album, Florence Shaw? How does that work when they come in? What's that collaborative process like?
Well, it's the same, isn't it, really? We kind of make the track.
Yeah.
And then, you know, leave a gap, leave a verse for them to fill.
Yeah,
and they, you know, and send them that, and then they know exactly where they need to put their vocal.
Yeah, it's basically, you know, we tell them what there might be an idea where for Billy No Mates collaboration. You know, I have the melody for the chorus, and then asked her if she wouldn't mind doing that, which she did, and then she added her own verse. You know, Florence, she just came in, did her own verse. And then I asked her if she'd accompany me on the chorus a bit. That was it, you know what I mean? We pretty much just tell them to do what they want. You know, there's a couple of pointers, but generally it's always interesting to see if they, you know, what they come up with by just doing whatever.
I've lived in Germany for, I think it's now 28 years. So originally British, and I've been here, you know, nearly half my life now. And for me, my perception of being British has changed in that time, because Britain has completely changed in my perception. Maybe it hasn't, but in my perception, it's really changed over that time. So what is it for both of you to, what does it mean being British?
Oh, God. Fucking weight around your ankle, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I suppose every country is the same for its citizens. There are gripes and you feel like it's Groundhog Day, you know, wherever you are, I guess. And, you know, I would imagine corruption is present everywhere, you know, in the same kind of way. It probably comes out in different ways, you know what I mean? But
well, you say that corruption is present, but isn't it, there's, you know, when you're away from Britain, you really see Britain as a class-based society, which is, in essence, from a feudal society.
That's interesting, yeah.
You know, you see it completely, you start to see it completely differently, or I did. I can only say my... So, yeah. and a class-based society, in a sense, I don't know how you can ever change it. So I just wondered, because, you write so much about British politics, and it's clear the unhappiness with how society runs in Britain, but how can it be changed?
Well, I don't think it can it? Unless there's some miraculous overhaul. But I don't think there will be. The public are stunted. They are, they've been conditioned into not overthrowing things. It's been like that for centuries, you know. There have been times where it's probably gone the other way, but that's usually been spearheaded by somebody at the forefront, you know, Cromwell, etc. You know what I mean? But you know, even that went pear shaped. So I don't think the idea of revolution is going to work, or the overhaul of a system, because what has got to replace it is another system run by human beings. You know, we are a chaotic breed, so chaos will ensure wherever we are. And, you know, I'd like to think that the class system will eventually die out another 100 years, 50 years, 100 years, God knows. But in its place will still be human governance. And, you know, we need to get to a place where we're not using distraction methods such as capitalism or fascism. And we try to work on our Achilles heels, which is weakness, hatred, you know, bitterness, whatever, you know. I don't think these things will change overnight. So the class system's here for a long time, yeah, I would imagine. But there's also something about, you know, there's a lot of Stockholm syndrome in each of us, you know. We kind of bizarrely love our captors, or we bizarrely, like myself, like moaning about them whilst conforming to the rules of society.
Yeah, I mean, you know, why don't we just all move to Germany? But, you know, which is a great idea, but we just don't seem to do it.
No, that would be a good idea,
I mean, what's fascinating is, you know, I sort of mentioned to a few people that I was interviewing you today, and Germans, and they obviously know your music, and they really understand the politics in your music and see it as relating to Germany as well, which really surprised me. Yeah. But it
doesn't really, you know, there's a far right, there's a massive far right presence, and it's growing in your country, in Germany, isn't it? So, so it doesn't surprise me in some respects.
During the early 80s, I would spend, you know, half my life on things like the Miners' March, you know, obviously the gay marches, the march against the poll tax, things like that. And there seemed to be a wealth of young people, when I was young people who were interested in politics in some way. And then by the late 80s, it seemed that music had moved away from being really politicized, and that young people had moved away from it. And I remember going back, I don't know when it was, 2015 or 2016, whenever that Brexit the Brexit marches were. So I flew back to England to go on those marches because I was invested, obviously, in that, although I lived in another country. So why do you think that, or really, what do you think you can achieve through your music and lyrics politically long term when it does seem that things ebb and move and people lose interest at some point?
We're not looking to achieve anything with it. Just telling people, you know, or not even telling people, just saying. It's not a mandate type thing. I don't believe that music can shift a whole audience's mindset. But you know, I'm just reporting on it lyrically. You know what I mean? That's it.
Maybe it can. I don't know. Do you know what I mean? I was just thinking about, like, you know, you had little things. I mean, even like the dance music era, you know, it did, you know, site parties, illegal site parties and all that sort of thing. That was kind of quite massive, you know, and like they quashed that by taking the figureheads and giving them shows on BBC radio, you know.
Yeah,
so,
true. Yeah.
You know, so you've got to try, haven't you? I think. Do you know what I mean? And like, it's surprising that we've managed to get as far as we have initially.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think anything is worth having a go, isn't it? You know. You never know, and it's down to the individual. Everything's down to the individual to be a bit more aware, a bit more, I don't want to say woke, because it's a clack, you know.
Well, it's right. It's been used as a derogatory term, or rather just another deflection. But I think woke is the idea, isn't it? It's like,
it is, isn't it?
It's got to be that. Because
yeah.
If it's not, then you're just being ignorant and you're not helping. Things need to change, because if they don't, people are, you know, the things that are affecting people that need to change, if they're not changed, then these people are still going to be hurt, you know. So you need to change, and boom.
I mean, one thing that can be changed is your own personal sphere, your own sort of bubble. And when it comes to things like ticket prices, when you look at, you know, the big American stars, when they go on tour, their ticket prices are just so phenomenally ridiculous that regular person, and I don't mean even someone who's really on the breadline, but no regular person at all can afford that anymore. So how much are you aware of that, and how much do you sort of try and make sure that people that can't afford to go to a concert can in some way come and see you perform live?
We've always tried to keep the price down, haven't we?
Yeah, I think the price has gone up about £5, probably £10 since we started. And I'm including buying fees in with that as well. I think, you know, the handler's fees or whatever. But yes, our manager and bookers always keep the price at a realistic level. It helps that we haven't got a massive back line. You know, we're not trailing around a band or music or instruments. We do have a lighting show. But only for selected gigs. So it's easy. It's not easy, but, you know, we can afford to keep the tickets at a reasonable price, you know. But I understand that some bands can't. But, yes, I agree. £1,000 to go and see someone's just taking the piss. I think, you know, given the way things are and how money is devalued or valued, you know, £120 to go and see someone at an arena, I think that's reasonable. It's a fucking arena, you know, and you know, it's not 1998 anymore, you know what I mean? But anything past 200, 250, it's just a bit, I don't know, you know. Mm. It just depends, doesn't it? Because you've got, and I'm not trying to justify it for them, but as you know, when you see what these people have to fork out for, I guess, lighting shows, catering, support bands, if they've got a massive fucking show, you know, if they want to put on this spectacle of entertainment, I suppose it needs paying for, but it's a tough one. I think £1,000.
What the show is, though.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's £1,000 just takes a piss for anything, though. Really.
Yeah.
It just does, you know.
Yeah.
And Andrew, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, just the same, really. You know, if it's just four blokes on the stage playing guitars, then
it's like,
it really costs that much money.
No, and, you know, kind of like meeting them and paying extra is, yeah, it's just.
So what do you put in your stage rider that is different to other bands?
Don't really have anything much, do we?
Don't have anything, no.
Is it not true that you say that it's only vegan food for everyone? And
well, no, I'm the vegan, so
yeah.
But I mean, even so, it's like, you know, it's a bit of fruit. I mean,
yeah.
Sometimes if we're touring a lot, you know, you don't get a chance to eat. So if, as long as like there's some, you know, vegan stuff, you can put in some bread. Like,
yeah.
Hummus or something, yeah. Do you know what I mean?
So I want to ask finally about, because people like Bob Dylan, Sting, Bruce Springsteen have sold their music rights for millions. How much do you want for Jolly Fucker?
I don't know.
I think I don't think we're the type of band to make a sizable amount off our back catalogue, not just yet anyway, you know what I mean? I don't think it would go, but yeah, I would, you know, don't know, we'd have to bang heads, but if we got to a point in life where it didn't matter and there was a sizable chunk, why fucking not? Yeah.
I'm sure at some point that might, you know, I mean, I don't know. It's weird because I think after last year, we've kind of obviously got bigger as a band, but
yeah,
you don't really, it's hard to really quantify where you're at, you know, or how big you are. And I guess those sort of things reflect that, you know.
Yeah, true. Very true. Who knows?
People aren't going to be doing, cover bands aren't going to be doing Jolly Fucker at weddings and things like that, are they? So
no, absolutely not.
Well, maybe they'll do it at funerals. You never know.
That's true, yeah.
Well, Jason Williamson, Andrew Thurn, thank you very much.
Thanks,
brilliant. Thanks.
Thank you.
Nice to talk to you, Steve. Bye-bye.
Okay, see you. Bye.